Hello, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine and cancer science, across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And my guest today, I think I would probably describe as one of the greats of his generation, Dr. Mark Soczynski. Mark, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Yes, thanks for having me, Ross. Well, I'm a son, I'm a sibling, I'm a husband, and I'm a dad as well as a stepdad. I'm also OG. My grandkids think it's old grandfather. I like to think it's original gangster. I kind of stumbled into having a career in lung cancer. That's over the past 35 year. That's kind of viewed myself, somewhere between a clinician and a clinical investigator. That's kind of my passion in the lung cancer space over those decades. So that's kind of how I see myself at this point in life.
Where are you currently working?
I'm at the Advent Health Cancer Institute in Orlando, Florida. I'm the executive director of the institute. Still doing my lung cancer activities. I have a very active clinic there, one plus day a week. And then the remainder of the week, I'm with my administrative staff, doing all the things it requires to kind of build and recruit talent into the institute. So
that's cool. Is the institute just like one building, as it were, or like one campus, or is it a network?
Yeah, it's as a whole has about 50 plus hospitals in 9 different states. But the division that I'm in is called the Central Division of Florida. We have, I think, 7 or 8 hospitals in the greater Orlando area, in the Cancer Institute is kind of draped over all of them. We do have a hub, if you will. This is the Orlando campus. It's a 1,200 bed hospital. We have a freestanding building, but we are currently in the design phase, a new 12-story cancer facility. In fact, later on today, I've got a design meeting to talk about the multidisciplinary floor that we're thinking about. So we're building a lot of infrastructure because of the growth in the cancer population. We did a study, Ross, about 4 or 5 years ago to develop our 10-year strategic plan for cancer in the institute. And our advisors said that you should expect to see about a 40% increase in the number of cancer cases over the next decade because of population growth and demographics. So that's kind of what we took as a serious challenge, if you will. And not only did we have to hire the necessary human infrastructure to take care of that population, but also needed a lot of physical infrastructure, one of which is a new cancer institute. Our current cancer institute was built in the mid-90s. So it served its purpose, and now we need to move on to a new facility. So that's what we're in the middle of at this point. So,
Well, let's go back in the time machine. So the young Mark Soczynski, so where was he born and where was he brought up?
I was born in small town rural Vermont. I always kind of describe it as the Norman Rockwell setting in Vermont. For those of you who know that artist, my parents were high school sweethearts. My mom, after high school, worked for a legal law firm as an admin type person. My dad went to Ithaca College, was a music major. By the time I was 24 months old, I had 2 brothers that were younger than me. So we had 3 boys.
They were very much in love by the time.
That's right. And then I've got a sister 5 years and another sister 10 years younger than I. So we grew up in a little town in Vermont. It was kind of like the picturesque childhood. I walked to school for 12 years. We had a little ski tow in our hometown. We had a skating rink. We had a swimming pool, which was actually a pond. But all of this was within walking distance of where we lived in this small little town. It was kind of picturesque, if you will. So I have very fond childhood memories. I don't think I could ever go back and live in Vermont right now, but I think in terms of growing up in that area, that it was kind of a very positive start to life, if you will.
You know, there's almost an analogy with like seeds and acorns. Like you start off small and then you grow, and you start off in a small town and then you grow. And that's a very common message that I get when I interview people.
Yeah. Unfortunately, my dad passed away about 3 or 4 years ago, but very early, I was very young at the time. He started his own business in the marble and granite business there and has built it from kind of the ground up, quite successful. My brother has taken the company, and at some point he had a buyout thing. So my brother's still running the company in the adjacent town. They had to find a different site for the company manufacturing sort of thing. And so that's, but still going strong. He's running it and making a living. And now his son has joined him in the business. So it is the family business. However, I was the one black sheep and didn't follow in the family business. So.
Sounds like it. So is that kind of like kitchen countertops?
It's all the way from, you know, my dad for years, and I believe they still have a government contract for veteran headstones. So, you know, the headstones.
Oh, wow.
You see. Yeah. So they were turning out 450 headstones a day at one point. And then all the way to the custom kitchen countertops, bathrooms, and whatever you can do with marble, they pretty much did. There are several buildings in New York City that they did the marble plaques and stuff like this. So a few things in Washington, and every once in a while he would have a commission the thing that, you know, some town was going to dedicate to the World War II veterans. And so he would kind of make the monument that they would have in the middle of town and that sort of thing. So
that's pretty amazing. I mean, that it's the fact that you can walk around and you can say, I can see that, and it's going to be there for decades, if not centuries. Some of these.
Well, my dad was very proud of that because he would take us around and show us.
Okay. Here's my favorite fact about you growing up is that you were the head altar boy. But you have to explain that, you know, to the rest of the world and everyone who's not a Polish Catholic, what an altar boy is.
Raised as a Catholic from a very Catholic family, my dad's side of the family immigrated from Poland. My dad's side of the family had a couple of nuns, had a Monsignor in there.
Had a couple of nuns. I love the way you dropped that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the thing to do at that time, we would, you know, go to church every Sunday. We'd sit in the back seat and my parents would be in the front seat. We'd go to the 8:30 mass on Sunday morning. And at some point, I forget what age you can be an altar boy, but the expectation was, that's what you would do. So I did that for about 10 years. So during junior high school, in high school, you know, we would rotate, I think 1 week out of every 6 weeks, I was the altar boy responsible for 7 a.m. mass, Monday through Friday. So I'd have to either walk or ride my bike down and be there at 7 o'clock, and then at 7:35 or 7:40, go off to school. And that was the rotation every 6 weeks or however it had to be done. But that's kind of what we did for 10 years. And then altar boys are there to kind of assist the priest, if you will. And, we would do baptisms, we would do funerals, we would do weddings, you know, all these sorts of things. So that's kind of that story from the altar boy point of view.
Didn't you tell me you got to distribute the workload amongst the other altar boys?
Yeah. You know, when you kind of been there, done that and had done it for several years, as the younger altar boys come in, you know, they just don't quite know what to do and what the expectations are. So you kind of, if you will, mentor them as young altar boys.
Yeah. I think I told you it sounded like organized crime, but you just use all of that.
Yeah. I guess there, you know, some analogies that might work there, but
yeah, the capo di tutti capo of altar boys. And then I think at this point we should probably tell people about the story of Greg.
Yeah. So, you know, getting back to, I had two brothers by the time I was 2 years old. So we were very close. And, you know, as you grow through, you start to get into sports and stuff like this. And the big sport, soccer. And so we all played soccer. And I remember this was in junior high school. And I remember my brother Greg not kind of being able to keep up. And he was a good player, every bit as good as anyone on the team. But then he started to kind of decline a little bit. And I remember I thought at the time that it was an issue of effort. But we subsequently found out that he was diagnosed with ALS. This was around 1969, 1970 and was diagnosed. I don't know the details of his treatment. In those days, the entire town was taken care of by our family practitioner, who was a wonderful man. And, you know, he lived for about 14 months or so, and then unfortunately passed away at age 12 when I was 13. I was just 11 months older than he was. In a small town, this doesn't happen. It was a tragedy that shone at the time. And to fast forward 55 years later, I was recently at my high school reunion, 50 years from high school.
Yeah.
And three of our teachers were there. You know, these guys are in their early 90s at this point, right?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
And one of them said to me, well, I can still feel all the emotions of when your brother died in like 1970, 71, and just what that did to our little community and how your family handled it and stuff. So here it is, 2025, and he's bringing up this event that happened in this picturesque little town of Proctor, Vermont, 55 years early. So I, you know, that kind of shook, not really shook me, but I wasn't expecting that sort of comment from him, but obviously it made an impact on, you know, just the gravity of being a child. And, you know, for anyone who has children, you just can't imagine going through that. And my parents were very strong. I think it made them a stronger couple, per se, because they had to rally, and they had four kids at the time. One of them was actually quite young. My sister was 10 years younger than I. So they kept the family together and was good. And we survived it. But, you know, again, having one of my high school teachers kind of remember that event and still kind of had some emotion surrounding it was quite meaningful. And this happened literally 5 weeks ago.
What did it influence your decision to go into medicine?
Maybe subconsciously. I didn't consciously say I want to be a doctor because this happened to my brother.
Yeah,
I was never interested in pediatric oncology.
Okay.
At all. In fact, that was one of the toughest rotations in medical school, was because my first patient on the floor when I did my 2 months of pediatrics in medical school was a young child with acute leukemia, and so that was difficult for me, and I had to, you know, kind of address that with the resident, and the resident was very empathetic and compassionate, and said, "Let's give you another assignment, and we'll move by that." And so, I don't think so. I think it was more the role that our family practitioner played in caring for everyone, including my parents. Was probably more influential to me. And, you know, I ended up doing, when I was in undergrad, ended up doing a couple weeks rotation with him, kind of following him around his practice to kind of see what it was like to be a doctor. And so that kind of sold me on the concept of going to medical school and that sort of thing.
Did you start with pre-med, or was your undergraduate degree in something completely different?
No, I started in pre-med, the typical biology major. I later switched to being a zoology major, Ross, because I didn't want to take the two required courses in botany. I wanted to I took, you know, political science, anthropology, economics, geology, and all the courses that I wanted to do with my liberal arts undergrad degree. And it was just kind of fun kind of picking. I took a computer science course rather than a biology major where you had to do these two courses in botany. I did opted to do some other outside of the, you know, traditional biology sort of major at the time. So,
and this was University of Vermont in Burlington.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So somewhere I'd written, and there was a brief period of time where you a paleontologist, but
well, yeah,
just short-lived.
Yeah. So this was before Indiana Jones, that whole series.
Yeah, he was an archaeologist. Paleontologist would be more like Jurassic Park.
Yeah, there was this, and I don't know what the fascination was at the time, but
it's because you were a little boy. Little boys like dinosaurs. That
might have been it, actually. But yeah,
I think you told me your dad had some sage career advice when you wanted to be a paleontologist.
Yeah, like how are you going to make a living?
and thereby, you know, the world gained an oncologist but lost a paleontologist, you know.
That's right. Yeah.
So yeah. You go to University of Vermont. Do you continue to the medical school at the same place?
Yeah. So, I spent 4 years as an undergrad and then was accepted at UVM School of Medicine. I got accepted at a couple other places, but at, you know, being an in-state student, the price of tuition was dramatically different for an in-state. And so I had a very wise uncle who kind of talked me off the ledge. For a while, I was accepted at Tufts in Boston and wanted to move, quote unquote, to the big city. And I don't remember exactly what the difference was in tuition, but it was like a sevenfold difference in tuition.
Yeah.
So he said, why do you want to do that to yourself and burden yourself with debt and stuff like this? It's not going to matter where you go. It's what you do with the degree once you have it. So he was influential there.
And then, so you go through medical school. At this point, do you have an idea, an inkling of what you want to do within medicine?
Yeah. So in medical school, University of Vermont had what they called a pre-doctoral program in pathology.
Okay.
So they offered it to the top students in the class. And so I did it. I took a year off from medical school. So made medical school 5 years, got a master's degree in pathology. But basically, the best thing about it is that when I decided to take the year off, and the interesting thing about the year is the first thing they do is they train you how to do an autopsy.
Ooh.
And so then you take autopsy call for the next 2 or 3 years and you get paid for it. So as a student, that was a great thing. So I learned how to do autopsies. And then I told them that if I were to do this year, I wanted to enter the graduate school. There was a new faculty member, a guy named Bill Urschler, who had come from University of Wisconsin, more of a hematology guy than an oncology guy. But I went into his lab at the time and did some work growing peripheral blood and bone marrow colonies and that sort of thing, and did some work in CLL, got a master's degree in that area. And that kind of set me up. And to be honest with you, I was more interested in the hematology side of hemonc than I was in the solid tumor side. But somewhere between the third and over the fourth year, I did an acting internship at Beth Israel in Boston when I was a senior. And I just kind of became more interested in the solid tumor side of things. And the pendulum swung 180 degrees. And, you know, when I ended up short tracking in medicine and going to Dana-Farber. And of course, at Dana-Farber, it's an oncology fellowship. And if you wanted to do hematology, you could spend 3 months at the Brigham.
Yeah.
But no one of the eight fellows in my class, none of us went to the Brigham to do 3 months of hematology. So, I used to tell the house staff when I was on service at between UNC and Pittsburgh, I'm hematologically impaired. Don't ask me any heme questions. I never trained in coag or benign anemias, you know, these thalassemias and hemoglobinopathies and all these.
Yeah, things. No, I'm the same. So. Yeah. Okay, so you go to the Farber, you do a fellowship in oncology, and then, you know, so super academic place. And then your first faculty job, would we call it a faculty job? Your first attending job, at least. You go
first attending job. Yeah, I joined a guy in private practice in Vermont. It was a clinical appointment at the University of Vermont. And I did general oncology for about 3-ish years or so. Maybe a little longer, and had initial fun for the first year or two, but then, I kind of missed, when I took this job, also part of the deal was at the time that we had the old fashioned CCOPs. There was a group called, Green Mountain Oncology Group.
Can you explain what CCOP is?
CCOP was a community-based oncology program funded by the NCI that would run cooperative group clinical trials so that you could get trials out to the community. That's where most of the patients are. It helped, obviously clinical trial accrual through the cooperative groups. But a gentleman named Jim Wallace had a longstanding grant from the NCI to run the Green Mountain Oncology Group. And I forget, there were 7, 8, 9 oncologists throughout the state of Vermont that were part of this. And so that was the attraction to me at that particular time. And there were some family ties back to Vermont. And my wife at the time felt very strongly about moving back to Vermont from Boston and that sort of stuff. We had a couple of kids at that time. So that was kind of the draw. But then having been in general oncology practice with an emphasis on lung cancer, I started to kind of miss that subspecialty, more academic environment, and didn't see myself after a couple of years, doing that for the rest of my life. I needed to kind of make a change. And so it took me a couple of years to figure out what that change was going to be. And ended up, long story short, with the position that I had at the University of North Carolina, which I joined in 1995.
It's funny because sometimes you have this perception that you go to community oncology and then that's a one-way street versus academia. But you and indeed one of your mentees, Tom Stinchcomb, done this bit where you go to community practice and then come back to academia. So was it hard? Did they welcome you back with open arms?
Yeah, how it happened, because, as part of the GMOG, we were part of CLGB, what we used to call CLGB.
Now that's a lot of abbreviations in one sentence.
That's right.
The GMOG CLGB, yeah.
Yes. I would go to the CLGB meetings, and I went to one of them, I think it was in Chicago, and I ran into a gentleman named Tom Shea. Tom Shea was a fellow at the Beth Israel. When I was an intern resident there, he was working with Karen Antman at the Dana-Farber, at the time interested in solid tumor autologous marrow program, STAMP program, doing bone marrow transplant for breast cancer patients. We all know that led to. But Tom left after he finished. Tom was from Chapel Hill, went back to UNC. I ran into him at CLGB, and we had a conversation, and Tom said, well, we're looking for someone to come and do lung cancer at UNC. And I said, oh, well, that's interesting, because I had done a lot of that in my fellowship. Arthur Skarin was one of my mentors there, and so I had that kind of orientation, to do that. At the time, UNC had a couple of thoracic surgeons. They had a very good small group of radiation oncologists in the thoracic space. They were hiring a wonderful woman from Sloan Kettering, Patricia Rivera, who's a pulmonologist interested in lung cancer. And I was the kind of final piece as the medical oncologist that joined that group. So that was the attraction at the time. But it took a couple of years to kind of get to that point.
So what year was that? What year did you get to UNC?
1995.
Yeah. And it's trying to put, where we are in lung cancer in the context of what was going on in 1995. Cool. It was like, had they even agreed chemotherapy was a good idea at that point?
Well, not really. There was an editorial written by Everett Vokes in 1993 about the Canadian trial that randomized patients to CAP versus best supportive care. And there was a kind of a pro-con, and Everett's editorial was the con against chemotherapy. And so I have several quotes from him about that, it shouldn't be considered the standard of care. And, Ross, you remember it was 1995 when the non-small cell collaborative group published analysis that suggested that cisplatin, based therapy could modestly change the natural history with a lot of toxicity associated with it. So it wasn't, the fact that lung cancer was a treatable disease really started to evolve in the middle 90s or so. Before that, there were skeptics that said this is not a disease that gets any benefit from treatment, which several fellows asked me, then why were you interested in lung cancer?
So what was wrong with you? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And I always say, my interest in lung cancer came out of two things, opportunity and mentorship. No one else wanted to do lung cancer, so there was the opportunity. And the attending that, you know, you, as you're a fellow, you kind of identify with different people. And the attending that I identified the most with was Arthur Skerrin. Arthur Skerrin was a wonderful man and very kind and smart and funny and just a good guy to be around. And he was the lung guy. He also did some heme stuff too, but he was the lung guy at the Farber, and that's kind of what I gravitated towards. So that's kind of my story of how I got into lung cancer. And then of course the pull to UNC with those other physicians, where we developed our what we called MTOP, another abbreviation, multidisciplinary thoracic oncology program, and that kind of launched, you know, our efforts at UNC.
And just to put it into context, is we may look the same age, but I'm actually not the same age. So 1995 was when I graduated from medical school. the thing where I first encountered you was, and I told you the story before, is it was where the developments were different types of chemotherapy. There were the next generation chemotherapy drugs, of which one of them was gemcitabine. And I encountered you in some medical education thing, and there was you, there was a guy called Chandra Balani, and there was probably one other person, and all of the other people were saying the trade name. They're all saying Gemzar, and you were still the purist, and you were saying gemcitabine. And I went, okay, so this is the guy who can swim upstream in the face of all of these other people in the room saying the thing. I was like, that's the guy I like. But that
it's still true. It's still true.
Okay. You like to swim upstream, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's I think it was, you know, the idea that progress could still be made even with these relatively blunt instruments that we had at the time. And so you started to make your name as, you know, the next generation chemo guy, some stuff with chemo radiation as well. I mean, what do you remember were your research areas?
Well, yeah. So one of the great people that I have worked with in my career is a gentleman named Julian Roseman. Julian is a MD, PhD, radiation oncologist. His PhD is in computer science, and he's just a brilliant man and a funny man and just a good colleague. And I remember when I first went to UNC, one of my first meetings was with Joel Tepper, who was the head of radiation oncology. But after that discussion, he said, you really need to talk to Julian. So I went to Julian. This was right when conformal radiotherapy was kind of coming into vogue. And of course, prior to that, it was the old, you know, two-dimensional, you did your plan off of a chest x-ray.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. And Julian said, you know, we can define the target volume of tumor, and we can deliver radiation conformally to this volume, and we can escalate the dose of radiation. And every radiation oncologist believed that if they can just get enough dose in, they can kill the tumor.
Yeah.
And Julian said, you know, we can give much higher doses. And I said, well, we should prove that. And Julian's response was, there are some things we don't have to prove.
Oh.
It's just better, he said. Yeah. And so we embarked in early 1996 on a trial that escalated from 60 gray to 66, 70, 74. We originally published that. We were the first to publish the 74 gray stuff, and we brought it into CLGB. We actually did a subsequent trial going up to 90 gray after the 74 gray. We did a BID study with our colleagues at Duke. And these were all investigator-initiated trials at the time. As I mentioned, our 74 gray trial got into a cooperative group trial where we looked at carbotax as well as carbogem with radiation. The gem wasn't a good idea, but the carbotax survived. And of course, we all know ultimately other cooperative groups did the 74 gray thing, ultimately leading to the intergroup trial comparing 74 to 60.
Yeah.
And of course, we know how that worked out. There were issues of toxicity, particularly cardiac, where the 74 gray was not better. But, you know, I'm not sure radiation oncologists, you know, believe that.
So you didn't go back to Julian and go, look, we did, the study got done, and that's why it got done.
That's right. this was also a time, as you mentioned, there were drugs like CPT-11, which we did several studies with at the time. This was just kind of mixing and mashing. You know, I like the term that Dave Ettinger had used when we had all these new chemotherapy drugs and everything. He saw himself as an oncologic chef. You know, how would he put these drugs together and stuff? And so, and then, you know, kind of getting into the more targeted area, if you will. We all remember the lifetime of the VEGF TKIs and stuff like this. And I had early involvement with sunitinib, and we had done a phase 2 trial. It ended up being one of the clinical science symposiums at ASCO. It was vandetanib, sunitinib, and sorafenib that were presented in the clinical science symposium. And my claim to fame is I had the nicest looking waterfall plot of anyone, but none of these drugs went anywhere in lung cancer.
Well, it wasn't that they didn't work, but they were fairly toxic. Didn't they worsen survival?
They didn't improve survival. We actually ultimately ran a maintenance trial with sunitinib and CLGB. Yeah. That again improved PFS, but didn't improve overall survival. So, you know, that was a trial that took painfully long to do and is published somewhere, but they had an effect. It's just that the potency of the effect wasn't enough to necessarily drive overall survival. And yes, there were toxicities issues with these drugs also.
Did I see you involved in one of the studies of Avastin? So the radiation.
Yeah, obviously after the ECOG trial and Avastin came into standard of care in stage 4 disease, you know, the ECOG was running the adjuvant Avastin trial, and there were several people that attempted to incorporate Avastin into bevacizumab into the platform of chemo radiation. And I believe the only site that or institution that actually completed a phase 1, phase 2 trial was us at UNC, and eventually was published in the JCO with a scathing editorial written by your colleagues David Raven and Paul Bunn.
Didn't it blow holes in people's esophagus? I mean,
No, it didn't blow holes. There are a couple of late pulmonary hemorrhage deaths on that, but we're talking 18 months after treatment and stuff like that. So the esophagitis was an issue. It's just it was 28, 30 patients or so. It wasn't a large trial, but the outcomes were not anything to in a phase 2 trial that you would want to move this forward. And in that way, in fact, if I remember correctly, the conclusion in the abstract that I wrote was kind of like, don't do this.
Oh, you know, this is pretty honest of you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, it was. And this is why I don't know why Rabin and Paul just kind of gave this scathing editorial. In fact, David Rabin ended up apologizing to me for the editorial.
Well, there are some people, if you give them a platform, they will start shouting from it. You know?
Yeah. You know, you live and learn. And, you know, like I say, the reason we do clinical trials is to find out the truth, right?
Yeah.
And the truth is the bevacizumab should not be used concurrently with radiotherapy. It doesn't appear to have an efficacy benefit, and there are issues of toxicity and safety. So again, my conclusion in the abstract was, you know, kind of don't, I don't know how I said it, but you know, don't do this.
Is not recommended for further development or something like
that. That's right. Maybe I said it that way.
You definitely put UNC thoracic oncology on the map, you know, and also kind of, you know, mentored, you know, a couple of generations of really good medical oncologists there. But how long were you at UNC in total?
16 years. From 95 to 2011.
And then what, you know, had you just said, okay, that's enough time in the South? What was the change?
One of the great things about the 90s we used to have a lot of multi-tumor meetings, and it was all centered around paclitaxel.
Okay.
You know, BMS was promoting paclitaxel, not only in lung cancer, but in, you know, breast and in ovarian. And so we would go to these meetings and we would meet other people in other disease. And one of the guys that I met was a guy named Ed Chu. Ed was at Yale at the time. He ended up taking the position at University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, Hillman Cancer Center. He was the chief of HEMONC at the time. At the time, Nancy Davidson was the cancer center director.
Okay.
And I ended up having a conversation. Oh, I think Ed called me and said, hey, Mark, we're looking, because I knew him from these meetings from the 90s, and we had always kind of gotten along, and Ed's a nice guy. And he called me and said, we're looking for a lung cancer guy. Do you know anybody? And I said, tell me a little bit more about, you know, the opportunity. So he did. And at the time they had a lung cancer spore. They had a much bigger department of thoracic surgery than they saw about four times the number of lung cancer patients we saw at UNC.
Yeah.
Chandra Balani had left UPMC 4 or 5 years before that. So there was basically no activity in lung cancer for about 4 or 5 years. So it was just kind of like a desert. I said to Ed, you know, after he kind of told me about the opportunity, I said, well, what about me? And he kind of laughed and he said, well, everyone knows you'll never leave Chapel Hill. I said, well, try me. So long story short, made a visit and made a couple other visits. And at the end of the day, saw it as an opportunity. And that was the next move and went there. And at the time, Paul had procured a funding for the Lung Cancer Mutation Consortium version one. And all the institutions with lung cancer spores were part of that LCMC. And so that was one of the first trials I opened when I got there. We accrued a bunch of patients. So that was good. And then, of course, the LCMC had all these targeted therapy clinical trials associated with it. So we opened those and opened up a bunch of other things. And so it was kind of, like I said, it was kind of like a lung cancer desert with lots of patients. And so that was the opportunity there. So
let me just explain for the audience. So the Lung Cancer Mutation Consortium was money, actually, as part of, I can't remember what the abbreviation was, but one of the stimulus grants during the Great Recession or something, to actually get broad panel molecular profiling going on in key academic centers. So essentially spreading the word. And that's presumably what happened. Actually, I had a question about, I remember. So this is, you'd been at UNC for 16 years. So are your kids grown up at this point, given that they arrived relatively early? Although how many kids do you have in total?
I have three from my first marriage, and my current wife has one from her first marriage. So technically four.
Okay.
And my kids, you know, believe it or not, my daughter is about to turn 40.
Wow.
And
wow.
My other kid is 36, and the other one is actually going to be 34 on Monday. So, okay. You know, they're all in their 30s. My stepson is 19, going to school in lower Manhattan. So he's a rising sophomore this year, but living in New York full time and seemingly having the time of his life.
It's a good time. It's good time. Young in New York is kind of fun, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you did the switch from UNC to Pittsburgh, how old were the kids? Were you dragging a family?
No. They were all in college. In fact, my daughter was out of college, and I forget the timing. I guess I didn't have grandkids until I was here in Florida. If I remember the date. Yeah. So my first grandchild was born the year that I came down to Orlando from Pittsburgh.
All right. Well, we haven't got there yet. We're in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
so you go to Pittsburgh, and then I remember you telling me something about UPMC as this weird mix of academic and community. Or maybe it's not weird. Maybe that's a natural mix.
Well, yeah. So long before I was ever even considering Pittsburgh, I don't know the details of this, but the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, UPMC, absorbed a U.S. oncology practice run by Stan Marks. So when they built the Hillman Cancer Center, which is a 4 or 5 story building, that community-based U.S. oncology practice basically moved in to the third floor, and the academic practice, which was the University of Pittsburgh faculty, was on the second floor. It's a model that can work. It's a model that's not without its issues.
Again, it does sound like two competing practices.
That's exactly what it is. And one practice makes 3 times the salary that the other practice makes. Yeah. So you can only imagine how that might settle with people. I think it's been an issue to many people, maybe not to some. It wasn't a big issue to me. I actually got along quite well with the third floor, only because I included them in our, you know, clinical trials in lung cancer. The nice thing about UPMC is they have about 25 community-based cancer centers around Western Pennsylvania, one in Ohio. About 17 or 18 of them had clinical trial infrastructure.
Yeah.
So I would hold a quarterly, first Monday of the quarter, I would get on with anyone who wanted to listen to me, including the trial nurses and the physicians at these 17 sites. And I would do my like little lung cancer talk an update. My first slide was, what is our mission? You know, let's talk about our mission, what we're trying to do. Here's what we've done. Here are the new trials coming up. Here are the issues that we're trying to address. Here's the accrual. Here's the accrual at Hillman, and here's the accrual from the community. Let's try to do better from the community because your guys are seeing more patients than I. So it kind of included the community-based guys in the academic effort. And, you know, no one else had done that at Pittsburgh. And so that kind of gave me good standing with the third floor people, even though the third floor people were out, you know, out in the community sites. And it was good. You develop relationships. They end up sending you a lot of second opinions, many of which went on clinical trials. Many didn't, but it was a good situation for the development of, clinical investigation in thoracic oncology at that time. So it worked well.
I mean, it must have helped the fact that you had that time in Green Mountain Oncology. You know, you were a card-carrying community oncologist at one point.
Yeah, right. So I was a member of that club at one point, right?
Yeah.
So and then the other great thing about that growth was when I was negotiating my a deal from UNC to Pittsburgh, I said to Ed Chu, I want to recruit 3 faculty members. So I recruited Lisa Villaruz. I recruited.
Oh, she's great. Yeah.
Yeah, no, she's fantastic. And I recruited Tim Burns, who's now at Ohio State, and a gentleman named Jim Herman, who's still at Pitt. Both Tim and Jim came from Hopkins. Lisa was a fellow at UPMC. So she was, in fact, I just had a conversation with her yesterday. We were talking about recruiting because they're looking for lung cancer people at Pittsburgh. And she said, I said, well, recruiting is a difficult process. And I said, but Lisa, you were easy. You know, you were a fellow at the time. You were living in Pittsburgh. You didn't want to leave Pittsburgh. So your recruiting was easy.
Yeah. And she probably had she goes like 4 sons or something like that. So she probably.
Well, she does now. At the time that I recruited her, she had not had any children, but she's got 4 beautiful little boys now.
I think it's pretty cool. So you were at UPMC. Oh, that was the other thing you told me. When you went to UPMC, this is the beginning of Dr. Sosinski guidelines guru.
Yes. Yes. So I, it's funny. And the 4 or 5 recruiting trips I went to UPMC, during none of those were the VIA pathways or guidelines mentioned at all.
Yeah.
Zero. In fact, I was not familiar with them. And then of course I show up on day 3, and someone, I forget who told me, said, you know, you're the chair of the lung pathway now. And I go, well, why do I need a lung pathway?
Yeah.
I know what I'm doing. And of course, if you turn the clock back to 2011 and what the state of treatment was at that point, it wasn't nearly as complicated as it is nowadays, right? So I, being the good citizen, I said, okay, let's take it on. Of course, as I mentioned before, the lung cancer space was kind of a desert. So no one had really kind of cared for the pathways for about 4 years. So they initially needed a lot of updating and stuff.
Can we try and explain what a VIA pathway is?
So the VIA pathway is an algorithm to get to a single choice of treatment, kind of the philosophy that 80% of experts can agree 80% of the time on a single standard of care. And by agreeing on a single standard of care, you decrease heterogeneity of care. You have the ability to control cost if everyone's doing the same thing, because you're making a decision based first on efficacy. But if efficacy cannot be distinguished, toxicity. And then if toxicity can't be distinguished, what's the cost? And so being part of that process, and as lung cancer became more complicated and there were many more therapeutics approved and stuff like this, I learned how tremendously valuable a pathway can be, particularly for someone who doesn't do lung cancer for a living. It's become quite complicated. And if you're the average community oncologist trying to keep up with not only lung cancer, but every other cancer, a pathway can be very helpful because you can get to what experts in the disease think is the best choice at the time. And of course, you and I spent, how many years were you my co-chair?
I don't know. It didn't feel very long, actually. It was probably only about 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. So that's what I would have guessed too. But I think there's some value in that sort of process. And of course, I don't know how involved you are in the new, I forget what ASCO is now calling it. They're transitioning their COPI certification to ASCO certified.
Okay.
In ASCO, one of the requirements to be ASCO certified as a cancer institute or a cancer program is you have to have a clinical pathway. And they do see the Elsevier ClinPath. That's one of the ASCO endorsed clinical pathways. They have actually quite a lot of requirements around pathway participation, pathway off pathway rates, and these sorts of things. I was kind of impressed that ASCO came up with this. Of course, I was in favor with it. So if you go back to 2011, Ross, they said, oh, you know, don't worry, you only have to do this for 2 years.
Yeah.
And so
you're still doing it, right?
I'm still doing it. Yeah. And I'm enjoying it, because over the years, I don't know how many co-chairs I've had.
But eat your way through them.
That's right. Yeah.
I was burned out after 4 or 5 years. I just couldn't take it anymore. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know what that says about me.
It is. It looks Tuszynski sucked the life out of me. That's what it says.
That's right.
So you go to Pittsburgh, and then is Pittsburgh somehow key to the VIA pathways, or because VIA isn't, it's not a Pittsburgh specific thing.
VIA was started at the University of Pittsburgh.
Oh, it was. Okay.
In 2005, commercialized in 2009.
Okay.
And I, you know, came in 2011. And then, you know, they grew. I wasn't, you know, part of their business plan, but they grew it and eventually sold it to Elsevier. And that's kind of where it is at this point. So.
And commercialized in the sense that another institution essentially buys into these pathways, can contribute Correct. To them, and then learn from them.
Correct.
Okay.
And how different institutions use the pathway. Like, for instance, when I was at UPMC, the expectation was that, my capture rate on the pathways was, plus the 90%, my on-pathway rate should be around 80%. It was an expectation. It was used as a measure of quality.
Yeah.
So that's what we're trying to do at my current institute, is to tell us what you do with patients. And if the pathway is not suiting, you know, what you think should be done, let us know. You know as well as I know, we had lots of questions about why is the pathway like this? And so, the pathway is kind of a living, breathing organism, if you will, constantly changing based on new data and just patterns of practice.
So I think when I first started working with you on it, you, I think, very nicely explained the difference between the pathway, and then something like the NCCN guidelines, the National Comprehensive right. Cancer Network guidelines, which are perhaps a little better known, but you explained to me the difference between a guideline and a pathway, and maybe it's an artificial distinction, but at least in your mind, how do you see it?
Yeah, no, I think there's a big difference, actually. You know, for instance, if you take the NCCN guidelines, which again are kind of pervasive in practice nowadays, the guidelines may list, you know, four or five different options. How many chemo IO platforms or IO platforms do we have that are FDA approved? You know, they're all listed there in the NCCN guidelines. If you're not intimately familiar with all this data, you get down to pembrolizumab. You know, that's your choice. The experts think that there's nothing better than this regimen. There are other regimens that might be equal to it, but nothing's better. So you have that one choice. It gets people to a point where they, on a pathway, they feel like, okay, this is the choice that the experts think is the best based on efficacy, toxicity, cost, maybe. But it kind of directs them to one choice versus leaving them with a list of six or seven FDA approved regimens. Yes, one may be a category one, or several may be a category one, or preferred, or these sorts of things. But it just has a little bit of ambiguity to it in terms of what should I choose.
Yeah, my time on the NCCN, the function was to say, look, if you think this is reasonable and we get it on the list, then insurance will probably approve it. But it still defers that decision making, you know, out of all of the available options back to the treating oncologist. And I felt as that list got longer and longer, it slightly removed the function of having an expert panel. I mean, what you have all these super smart people in the room, and then you go, that sounds all right. You know, whereas yours is a bit more draconian. It's like, no, you were first, and you know, you get, you know, everyone else has to beat you. You know, so there's definitely a first past the post, you know, in the pathway.
Yeah, so I've come 180 degrees. And you know, the complexity of taking care of a cancer population has dramatically increased. And, you know, I don't know about you, Ross, but I mean, can you imagine being in general community practice nowadays and taking care of everything that kind of walks through the door at the time?
I think I'd be doing a lot of Googling.
Yeah, Dr. Google, and up to date and stuff. But I would not have the level of confidence that I have just doing lung cancer. You know, I've done lung cancer for a long time. I've been around a long time. And so the decisions you make, you're comfortable with them based upon your experience and judgment and knowledge of what's been in the past and what's here now. It's just a different level of confidence. Whereas if I had to make a decision in a breast cancer patient, I wouldn't have the level of confidence clinically that I have, you know, doing what I do.
You know, it's funny. I interviewed one of the oncology brothers, Raul Gusain. And if I go back to, you know, you in, you know, Green Mountain Oncology, whereas, you know, 20 odd years ago, and that sort of, gosh, this is getting a little samey. His excitement is that there's so much coming out, and it is a challenge to speak up, but he finds that very exciting. So the idea of, you know, private practice is going to be terribly samey has sort of gone out the window. It's like private practice is, you know, insane churn of developments. And, you know, if you're up to keeping up with it, it's, you know, the most exciting thing in some people's minds.
Well, yeah, I can see that perspective. And you know, I remember when I was a medical student, I was doing my OBGYN rotation. I don't know if I told you this, but I had to go to some community practice in Portland, Maine. University of Vermont's sister, one of the sister hospitals was Maine Medical Center. And so we were expected to do a rotation during medical school over in Portland, Maine at the Maine Medical Center. And I knew I didn't want to go into OBGYN. So I said, well, why don't I do that over there? And I remember going to this guy's office, and he said, have you figured out if you want to be a doctor that knows a lot about a little or a little about a lot? And I said, well, I hadn't thought about that, but I think I want to know a lot about a little. So that's kind of been my mindset.
Yeah. It's like, you know, do you want to be an expert, or do you want to just be an actual really useful person wherever the situation
is? That's right. That's right.
How long did you spend at UPMC?
A little over 5 years.
So not that was a relatively short stint for you.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. You know, did Florida come calling because you were approaching retirement age, or was it?
No. So now we're kind of about a little over 20 years in academic practice. And, I had been tenured at UNCA. I was tenured at University of Pittsburgh. I've been there, done that in the academic world. And I started to think, am I just going to be a lung cancer doc all my life, or is there something else? And I had a list of jobs I didn't want to do.
Okay.
I had the opportunity a couple of times to be a hem-onc chair in a hem-onc division in a traditional academic, Department of Medicine. That didn't seem to be attractive to me. I had a couple opportunities in the industry world that didn't seem to be an attractive thing to me. And I was invited to be part of a national advisory board back around the year 2000 for what was at that time Florida Hospital. And they put together a national advisory board. I was the most junior person on this board. I'm not quite sure how I was asked to join it, but Larry Einhorn was on it. Dennis Slayman was on it. A couple other, high ranking officials, if you will, were on it. And we would meet in person in Orlando once or twice a year just to give advice about development of their cancer program in Cancer Institute. And so I was kind of familiar with them. Then they kind of disbanded the advisory board around 2004 or five or so. And then, 10 years later, I'm asked to do an ASCO review at Orlando for this organization. And 2 weeks before the ASCO review, they send an email around saying, hey, we're looking for an executive director for the Cancer Institute. Let us know if you have any names. And so I said, that's kind of interesting, because I knew them from 10 years ago. I knew what they aspired to. And I said, well, okay, tell me about what you're looking for. And six visits later, I ended up taking the job because a financially sound, large healthcare organization that had a legacy of generalist sort of organization from a medical staff and medical care point of view that really wanted to up their game in cancer. They had made a board decision in 2014 that they wanted some sort of NCI designation.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure they really understood what that really meant, but they had aspirations to do it. They just didn't have the bench to do it. They didn't have anyone in a leadership position. Long story short, we took six visits in recruiting because I wanted to be sure that I understood that they were really committed to cancer and that they understood what it was going to take to reach their aspirations, and that the people that were not physicians that I would work with were people that understood all of that and that I could work with. And I convinced myself of that. And here I am 9 years later. It's been an interesting journey. The organization continues to be very supportive of the development of the Cancer Institute and the cancer program. We've recruited lots of people, recruiting even more people. And this is across not only medical oncology, but surgical oncology and all the disciplines of surgical oncology, radiation oncology, palliative care, nurse navigation, all the components of what it is to be a cancer institute. And so we're growing and, we're building the infrastructure. I don't know if I mentioned this before, but
you said they're putting up a new building
because we need the physical infrastructure. And so, and the organization has been very supportive of that. So it's been, at the end of the day, it's been fun to be part of this, and we've recruited a lot of good people, some general oncology community type people, and also, we recruited the several people from various academic institutions. Most recently, a gentleman from the Farber that is a GU guy, but also early phase one. We've had a very successful opening 3 or 4 years ago of a clinical research phase one unit that's going gangbusters at the current time. So there was the first one in Central Florida. So it's all kind of coming together. We had a very good showing in the U.S. News and World Report earlier this week. So
excellent.
We're doing all of this without an academic anchor. You know, we don't, we aren't associated with a medical school or university of any type. If people are interested in an academic title, we have ways to do that with a couple of local universities and stuff like this. I personally didn't feel like it was important to me at the time, but to some people it's important. So you could
You're called the executive director, so you don't have to worry about other titles.
That's right. That's
like when you're God, you're God, right? You know.
Sure, right. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's how the now Advent Health story kind of turned out. And so we'll see. I don't see retirement on my horizon yet, Ross. I don't know. You pointed out you're much younger than I am. So I don't know what you're thinking, but I, the last year of my second 5-year contract, I'm going to negotiate for another 5 years, and I want to see this 12-story building through and see patients in it and just see how much the organization will grow. And the gratifying thing is continuing to take care of patients in a high quality way across the board.
Yeah.
Lots of this is, I always say to anyone who will listen to me, we get out of bed in the morning to care for cancer patients.
Yeah.
And all of us want to do a high quality job, but it never feels good when you don't have an experience that you would want your family member to have.
That sounds like a perfect point to wrap it up. Mark, thank you so much for sharing your journey, and I wish you the best of luck in the future.
Thank you, Ross. It's been great.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with hosts me, D. Ross Camage. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on @DRCamage on Blue Sky for additional commentary.